beat his feet.
The year was 1998. Crooner Frank Sinatra had just passed away. Titanic picked up 11 Oscars, including Best Picture, and Cher's Believe was the top hit on the radio. Meanwhile, a lawsuit against Microsoft was beginning to garner headlines, the result of almost a decade of investigation by the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, alleging that the Bill Gates-led software behemoth was abusing its monopoly power to shut out competition. It's been over a dozen years since the U.S. sued the largest existing software company for anti-competitive activity. That case closed with a settlement in 2001. It has not been surpassed in scale and significance, though the tech sphere has grown by leaps and bounds. But even this many years later, a number of questions still remain. Did the case improve the environment for competition, or in fact have any effect at all? Have today's leading technology companies learned any lessons from this case? Did Cher's use of autotune predict the demise of quality pop music? This week, as a special treat, friends of the show Jonathan Zittrain and Larry Lessig reflect on the Microsoft case and the future of competition in technology. This is the first in a regular series we hope to do in collaboration with Jonathan and Larry, where we take a complex legal technology issue and try to break it down to size. We've put together a package of deep links to go with this primer on competition, including a bite-sized podcast with co-producer Molly Sauter and myself, with perspectives from leading technology thinkers like Siva Vaidyanathan and Ken Aletta on how big shots like Microsoft, Apple, and Google are dealing with competition. You can find that at our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. But before you click anywhere else, stick around and listen in as Larry and Jonathan tackle competition.
Well, good morning, Larry.
Good morning, John.
I'm particularly happy to be here with you today to take stock of current issues on the internet through the lens of history. And who better than to have in your seat than you, because you were both witness and participant to a certain slice of history, the Microsoft case, that I think everybody has tried to pretend never happened because it was just this huge, boring vortex of antitrust mishigas, as we might say.
Yeah, I tried to pretend it didn't happen either.
So. Exactly. So that's why we're bringing up such a painful memory.
Wonderful.
Our hope today is to talk to you about the case as a way of thinking about current battles for dominance on the net, where it seems like little Davids are popping up all the time, but there's still Goliaths to be dealt with. And ultimately, are there ways in which public policy, regulation should intervene?
Great. Let's talk.
Okay. So help us out just with the basic structure of the Microsoft case in, you know, tweet-length summarization.
With the abbreviations or?
No, not using the LOL. I mean, just, you know, quickly, what was the essence, the nut of the Microsoft case as you saw it?
So there's a lot of argument about that, right? But my view is the essence of the Microsoft case was there was a company with a monopoly that tried to use its power over the monopoly to protect itself from competition in its monopoly market. So remember in the old days, there was the Windows operating system that every single computer had, or 95% of computers had. And that Windows operating system made a lot of money for Microsoft because people would write applications for that operating system. And then other people had this idea that maybe we could begin to build a cloud and begin to have applications that ran on the network or depended on the network and not upon any particular operating system. So the idea that Sun had with Java was that Java would be a programming language where you could write the program once and it would run on every operating system. And people would use Java with a browser like Netscape that would allow a single browser and a single thing like Java to run on every single operating system. And that began to create the vision of a world where people wouldn't care about writing programs for the Windows operating system anymore.
Because they'd write them for Java, and Java could run on anything.
Exactly right. So the threat, at least as perceived by Bill Gates in a famous memo in April of, I don't remember the year anymore, but April 4th, I think, of whatever that year was, he woke up and he thought, oh my God, the world is going to write for a different operating system, and we're going to lose our power. So we've got to fight a war against this browser and against this Java to make sure that alternative universe doesn't come into existence. And that decision and the subsequent actions following that, I think, was the core of what made Microsoft guilty of an antitrust violation, because they used their power over the technology to block somebody from competing with their underlying monopoly. They were allowed to have their monopoly. That's completely legal. But what they're not allowed to do is to use that monopoly power to protect the monopoly from another competitor.
Got it. So now a question that I'll try to make relevant later, but be great to insert right now, which is, if Microsoft had chosen to write an operating system that simply didn't allow outside code at all, everything you got when you got a Windows machine came from Microsoft. There was Office applications like Excel, there was Solitaire, et cetera, and there was just no opportunity for software developers to write at all. Would that have been an antitrust violation?
Well, of course, if you know, you think back to that time, if somebody had written such an operating system, and effectively there were, it never would have become 95% operating system for the world, right? So there's this chicken and egg problem with this exercising this kind of control. Microsoft became the platform, the standard, because they developed and encouraged developers to write programs for that standard. And they didn't really care what the programs were as long as people were using the operating system. There were lots of allegations, of course, that for certain applications, they were really keen to make sure there wasn't competition. So remember, there used to be a program called WordPerfect. Most lawyers still use WordPerfect, but there was this program.
We're sending out a Shift F7 to all you WordPerfect users out there.
And there's lots of allegations that what Microsoft did was to use its power over its operating system and bundling with Word or Office to kill off WordPerfect. And, you know, that may or may not have been true. But the point is, they were not in the business of trying to kill off program developers. They wanted people to write applications for their operating system. It's just certain applications that threatened their monopoly, they, at least in this one instance, seemed to act quite vigorously to kill.
But just to pin you down on this, on the theory, in theory, had Microsoft chosen not to open up at all and somehow, despite the tides of history, managed to achieve 95% market share, no problem?
Harder problem for an antitrust enforcer.
Got it.
I think,
So part of the weirdness is that they open up some, and once they open up some, they have some potential obligation through the intricacies of antitrust doctrine not to start being picky about what applications they will favor one way or another, especially if those applications relate to their own operating system dominance.
I would be much narrower. I would say the only thing they got to worry about is when they start trying to protect their own dominance. Everything else is not a problem. So common example we've talked about a million times is Solitaire. Solitaire was bundled with the Windows operating system. No doubt there are poor Solitaire coders out there who said, my whole livelihood was destroyed because this free product was bundled
in
Windows.
Which is actually fitting, since Solitaire is such a destroyer of lives, too. But anyway.
But in my view, there could have been no problem with that, because there was no way in which, you know, having free Solitaire out there was protecting the Windows operating system against another operating system competitor.
Right? Got it.
So in that sense, I would be as narrow as you could possibly be about
that.
Got
it. All right. That sets the stage very nicely.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Sure. One other question before we start relating past stuff to future stuff, which is, it seems acknowledged in scholarly circles that Microsoft, as you say, had a monopoly, that there were instances of abuse of the monopoly in the way you say. And in fact, they did lose the case, at least on a legal sense. They lost the case after many appeals and arguments and such. Do you think the case actually made a difference? If somehow Microsoft had managed to win the case through great lawyering, would they be in a dominant position today? Was there this threat of lock-in unless the law had stepped in, now that we can look back?
I do think the case really mattered. I do think that the competitors were encouraged to think about how they could take on Microsoft because of that case. Of course, nobody tried to take on Microsoft directly in the operating system space. It's not like Apple then decided, now we're free to try to become the operating system for all PCs. But there were lots of ways in which I think the market was encouraged. Losing that case certainly had a pretty dramatic effect on Microsoft. They got more careful. One of the biggest things Bill Gates was always terrified about was that Microsoft would become IBM. Remember, IBM lost a big antitrust case and then became overly careful and couldn't innovate and couldn't do anything, and nobody really cared about being with IBM anymore. And many people might wonder whether that's in fact what happened to Microsoft, right? When you and I began in this business, Microsoft was the cool place to work. It was the cool company. It was like people graduated and they wanted to all go work there. That was one of the.
And I should say, by way of brief disclosure, I spent a lovely summer working for Microsoft as a program manager intern. The shrink to fit button on Excel, I helped spec out. Let's pause for applause here. And also by way of connections to the case. Larry, you were special master in the case for a brief shining moment.
Yes.
Until you were not special master
in the case
anymore. Yeah. And then you wrote an amicus brief at the request of the district judge. I also worked briefly for the Justice Department and clerked for one of the judges who heard the appeal of the case. And I think that conflicts us out in every possible direction. So, all right, just to have that straight. Okay, so now let's bring this forward to today. Less to see if there's something the Justice Department should be banging the bars about, and more to say, for those who have some abiding worry about market concentration, say me, worried about internet appliances getting locked in, and people have, one of my favorite topics is iPhone or iPad, but it could be any of these smartphones that reinforce the position of the vendor as people use the device more and more. Are there lessons from the Microsoft case that can shed light on today's situations?
Yeah. So again, let's be clear. We're not trying to make a prediction about antitrust violations right now. But one of the most important things that came from the Microsoft case was preserving an environment or a platform where lots of people could compete and come up with the next great idea for how that platform would be used. And often the next great idea is not an idea which the owner of the platform likes, right? Because it destroys their business model. So I hope we'll get a chance in another episode to talk about the internet and network neutrality, but that's the core issue in network neutrality. If telephone companies got to decide whether there would be voice over IP on the internet, there wouldn't be voice over IP on the internet, because why would you allow the internet to give away for free something you want to be charging for when you're charging for long distance? So there are plenty of places in the modern network where extremely important platforms have asserted the right to control whether people get to innovate or how people get to innovate on top of them. You've written about this. So let me turn it around, John. Tell us a little bit about, for example, Facebook. What's Facebook's current policy about the ability for people to develop applications for the Facebook environment?
Well, Facebook is a really interesting example because it's not positioned in the first instance, in the public eye at least, as an operating system of any kind. It's a place you go to to make friends and to, cultivate your crops in Farmville. But it then turns out that Facebook, I think, quite astutely saw the opportunity to invite outside coders to code for Facebook. And it actually nicely connects back to the Microsoft example of yesteryear, because when we look to see what actually happened in history, Java didn't kill Windows. In fact, Windows isn't dead exactly, but it didn't destroy the dominance of mindshare that Windows had. What did was simply the web itself. I think what was actually missing in all of our analyses 10 years ago was appreciating how much ubiquitous good bandwidth would mean there's no reason to be running code on your machine all the time.
I understood that.
You understood that.
Yeah.
You did. Yeah. You just kept it secret because you didn't want to ruin the surprise for the rest of us. It must be tough having to show such discretion.
I'm so glad you finally see that.
Yes, exactly. What are you holding out on now about the next 10
years?
Exactly. Well, we'll have to revisit that. But it's amazing how much what ultimately has meant that the operating system you're running on your machine doesn't matter so much is just the existence of the web browser at all. And almost any web browser. And it's funny how much there's like 8 web browsers actively right now. It's like the most competition ever for a free thing. Nobody's buying web browsers, and people are clamoring for you, please use our web browser, which is kind of strange. But we digress. Facebook, accessible through a web browser, means that if somebody has something he or she wants to code out in the world and share with the world, he or she can write it for the Facebook platform. It'll take care of any identity management the application might need, because that's the point of Facebook, knowing who is who and who's friends with whom. And Facebook then becomes a platform on which it runs, with one crucial difference to me, which is Facebook is a service and not a product. At the point your PC leaves the factory in the traditional mode, the vendor of the operating system and the PC have nothing to say about what you should do with it once you get it into your house. You can load on any code you want. And the Microsoft case was about defaults. It was about what happened when you first took the computer out of the box, because if you double-clicked on IE, Internet Explorer, when you first opened it, that was likely what you were to stick with. But if Firefox were in front of you, or Netscape, as it were, then maybe you would start using Netscape and its Java complement. So Facebook innately means, as a service rather than a product, that at any moment it can change the relationship between a software developer and you, the person running the software. If Farmville somehow crosses Facebook, no more Farmville for Facebook, subject only to the competitive pressures that if Farmville is eliminated from Facebook, a bunch of people might stop visiting Facebook because all they do there is tend their crops. So it's an amazing model, that shift from product to service, that means...
But it's quite explicit, right? I mean, and this is the point that you've written about.
Yes.
I mean, it's right there in the agreement that you sign as an application developer, that Facebook has an unrestricted right to pick and choose which applications
Correct.
Are going to run on Facebook.
Correct. And you might ask, if you're one of these, you know, the market is perfect types, well, why would a vendor of software choose to agree to such a one-sided agreement that basically says, Facebook says, we reserve the right to charge you whatever price we want to continue running your app on Facebook. You know, we'll get back to you. Don't call us. We'll call you. And why would somebody agree to that? And I think the answer from a behavioral standpoint is the apps I'm most interested in are actually apps written by geeks in a garage who don't read the fine print, who don't care what the fine print says, and therefore are immune to any conditions that seem oppressive. They just write the app, and only later when they get hit by some condition that the license allows do they feel bad about it. So they're not really looking ahead. And for others, even those who do read the fine print, those who have to do a presentation to a room full of venture capitalists and say why millions of dollars should be invested in this thing that will hinge on it being a successful Facebook app, they just say, this is where the party is. This is the dance floor. And I don't know what the landlord's going to do, but if you want to sell your vodka, like, this is where the party intends.
Right, and
are.
Let's just emphasize how much the dance floor this is. 500 million people are now users of Facebook.
Yes.
Right? And increasingly, for a generation, they don't even use email anymore because Facebook is the only way in which they connect with people. And, of course, you can't port those connections easily outside
yes.
of Facebook. So this is the platform for a huge proportion of the future of the internet. And that platform is owned by a company that asserts it gets to pick and choose which applications will run. Now, again, imagine Microsoft in 1998 had issued a terms of service for using the Windows operating system that says the only programs that are allowed to run on the Windows operating systems are the ones that Bill Gates approves. I mean, everybody would have thought that's outrageous. Yet only you, for whatever weird reasons you can explain, are saying there's something outrageous about what's going on with Facebook.
Although it is interesting, because when I asked you the hypothetical about Microsoft completely closing things off, you said it was kind of complicated, but they were basically entitled to do it. And as far as them playing around with what apps could run and what couldn't on Windows, you said only those apps that helped defend the original monopoly that Microsoft had were the ones that you would be extremely skeptical about at Microsoft.
For antitrust purposes. Right,
but
one very important thing for people to remember is that antitrust is just a small bit
yes.
of figuring out what good competition policy looks like. Right?
Got
and
it.
There's lots of reasons why the law wouldn't want to intervene to prosecute some behavior by a company. But still, from a public policy perspective, we'd be better off if that company behaved differently. So I wouldn't see antitrust violation in lots of these cases. But I do think there's an interesting thing to recognize that we are building these platforms that are increasingly concentrating an enormous amount of power, and they are reserving and asserting the right to do whatever they want with people who build for the platform or people who use the platform.
You are listening to a very special season premiere of Radio Berkman. This week, we listen in on Jonathan Zittrain and Larry Lessig as they talk about the nature of competition in the technology sphere. A lot has changed in the dozen years since Microsoft was hauled into court for anti-competitive activity. Since then, a great deal of our interaction with technology has moved from the desktop to the cloud, creating new challenges for how we understand the market and whether we step in to regulate it. Jonathan asked Larry about Facebook.
So with your Facebook example, would you see that as something which there may not be any antitrust case to be made against Facebook right now? It's not even clear that Facebook has a monopoly or at least a contestable monopoly in anything, despite the fact that you can't take your friends easily with you. You can just, come on, Friendster is waiting. They've added new servers. Let's go back. But you think there's a public policy issue nonetheless with Facebook's existence right now?
Public policy issue in the sense that it's something that we ought to think about, not in the sense that there's something the Justice Department ought to think about or in the sense that prosecutors in Connecticut ought to think about. I think that, you know, what we are seeing is something not any of us really predicted 10 years ago, which is the evolution of these islands.
You predicted it. You just didn't tell us.
No, that's right. Didn't publish about it. Yes. Right. These islands of these island platforms, right? So Facebook is one. We can talk about others like the iPhone island. But these islands that are drawing people in and keeping them and extracting enormous amount of values from that. Google is another one, right? And how we think about that from a policy perspective, I don't think any of us have figured out.
And in fact, there may even be islands of the sort you describe that are centralized, both logically and perhaps physically, like Twitter, that have extremely open for the moment policies so that somebody can write a client that somebody uses to tweet and you never have to visit twitter.com, encounter an ad from Twitter or anything else at the moment in order to tweet in and to read other people's tweets. So it feels like almost just a public utility supporting utterances by people and robots.
Absolutely.
But it's also, just as a matter of kind of internet security, a single point of failure. If Twitter were to go out of business, like, there go the tweets. You have to rewrite a bunch of code around the world to somehow work with whatever Twitter successor.
Yeah, Twitter is actually a more dramatic example of the Facebook effect than Facebook, right? Because it's had much quicker growth than Facebook.
Yes.
And it did all of its growth by, from the very beginning, saying, here's our APIs. Write whatever you can for our stuff. Of course, it had some technical problems in supporting that, but still it worked very hard to support
that. But then that turned lemons into lemonade. People love the fail whale.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But then
it's like, I win.
But then recently there was some, you know, Twitter began to say, well, you know, we might be folding some of these functionalities back into the core product. And you could just see among developers for Twitter kind of a Twitter of anxiety as they begin to think, my God, my whole enterprise is now going to be swallowed.
We knew this day could theoretically come. We didn't actually think it would come.
And here it is. Right.
And that's the weird thing about what I would call these contingently generative platforms.
Yeah.
You know, it's generative now, but as Captain Kirk would be told or would tell Scotty, for how long, Mr. Scott, for how long? With that, should we turn to potential questions and interjections from our studio audience of illustrious Burke Turns?
So let's turn the lights down so we can see people in the audience.
So my name is Andy Settlers. I'm a law student at George Washington University. I guess my question is antitrust and character, but I wanted to sort of get your reaction more as a layperson than as an antitrust scholar. 10 years ago, around the Microsoft case, we talked a lot about entrenchment and the ability of companies to have a monopoly power in a technology world because it is largely based on what network effects, what people were interested in going to, and who knows what will come along and upset the balance. And in the end of the day, that argument didn't really carry for Microsoft saying, well, who knows, how could we have a monopoly power because technology can always change. But I suppose my question is, was that true then? And 10 years later, is that true now? Could a search engine appear that upsets the power of Google? Could a social network appear which upsets the power of Facebook? And do you see that as something that could, you know, develop in the future?
That's a great question. Larry, why is Google's market share, which in some markets, including the U.S. market, is quite high, why isn't that totally contestable, that if Schmoogle came along and was better at what it did, people would just switch to Schmoogle?
Well, one reason is what Google has is not just a search engine. What Google has is a data layer, and the data layer is fed by the search engine, but it's also fed by everything else that Google has, the Mail app, every single application they have, in some sense, are feeding back to this data layer. And this data layer is so valuable because it gives them a much more efficient advertising model than the next guy. So you might create the next great search engine, but it's not going to have all of this enormous amount of data that Google's been able to build to help it feed and figure out what the next great search, next great ad technology is. So in this sense, you know, you could, again, compare it to Microsoft. Microsoft had a monopoly at the operating system level. If Google has monopoly power, and I'm not saying they're a monopoly or they have, you know, antitrust issues, but whatever they've got, it's much more significant than just having a monopoly at the operating system layer, because it's reaching across a wider range of the way that people connect to the internet and do stuff on the internet than just the operating system, and has a potential to hold people in. Now, there's lots, you can imagine lots of ways in which they lose that. You know, Facebook thinks that it's the Google killer, right? Because it has a much better understanding of the 500 million people who use Facebook than Google's techniques would give it. That's its belief. And, you know, depending on how iAds develop, Apple thinks it has a nice way to kill Google's ad thing, too, by bundling ads into things like applications or the apps, which are much more effective than what Google has. So I'm not saying there aren't ways to think about the competition, but it becomes, as you get to the large numbers like this, it becomes very hard. If you need a 500 million people to compete with a 500 million people, we only got so many 500 million peoples around this world. Now, we might discover another universe, to invoke the Spock point. But cloning would be another idea.
But that's interesting, because it does reframe then, right? There's this fierce competition, not just in browsers, but in search engines. There are a lot. Last time I looked, you know, you can see tumbleweeds blowing through some of them. Dogpile, anyone? But there are lots of search engines, and they're all free. Like, why are they competing? So, of course, one reason they're competing is because if you use them, ads get shown to you, and occasionally someone appears to click through on an ad. I got to say, I don't think I've ever intentionally clicked a sponsored link in my life. But I guess at some point, Google will know me so well that it will provide me exactly what I want. Like, the minute the pipe bursts in my office and water, it's like, mops, mops, who needs a mop? I'm like, you know, I could use one of these so-called mops. So it helps reframe it, though, to say the real grail here is not to write the best search engine, because, boy, search engines are what people need. It's almost arbitrary what you're writing the best of. The whole point of it is to be able to get a dossier on people, not in some spy sense, but in the sense of get to know their needs so well that for any given impression of an eyeball, you can offer an advertiser the hope of a click-through far more likely than somebody that doesn't know that consumer.
Right, and that's a very interesting thing about the difference of perspective between these companies and the people who use their products, right? So I often, you know, watch the fight about Facebook and privacy, and you see this duality. On the one side, you know, there's Facebook, who the people who created Facebook and who manage Facebook and try to make money at Facebook, of course, view the users as sources of data that help them monetize and sell ads and make money for different companies. But there are very few users of Facebook, even though there's 500 million of them, who actually think of their relationship to Facebook as, I'm showing you the insides of my soul so that you can sell things to me in a better way.
They're showing the insides of the soul just because they're exhibitionists.
Or they have their friends they want to show to, whatever. Right. But the point is, there's such a mismatch in expectations. And it's almost, I'm not saying that Facebook does this poorly. I don't know how you would get over that mismatch in a way that's not going to create lots of blow-ups of frustration and anger as people realize that they're dealing with somebody for different reasons than they thought.
Got it. Other questions?
Hello. I'm Georgi Krivokapic, intern at Berkman Center and PhD student at the University of Belgrade. Let's assume that Farmville has a competitor at the Facebook. that competitor says, like, we have antitrust competition case against the fire mill. So hypothetically, who would be the competent body to solve that antitrust case? Like some national regulatory, Facebook and its policy, or somebody third?
So if you imagine some hypothetical war among app developers, which would not just have to assert some monopoly by a fellow app developer, but bad behavior on mm-hmm. top of it, mm-hmm. is the fact that we're talking about a global phenomenon complicating to any attempt to resolve a dispute?
Yeah, well, it's the great embarrassing fact about the way competition law functions, that it is national in the sense that different nations can apply their competition law to activities that happen or affect their nation. Well, in the internet world, that means every nation gets to apply their competition law to what happens in the space. So in your hypothetical, imagine two applications that are fighting and one engages in behavior that's illegal under the law of competition law of Europe. Sure, Europe could bring an action against that application developer for the behavior that's affecting people in Europe. In fact,
we've seen that in the Microsoft case,
absolutely.
That the European Commission has decreed a certain set of screens that have to do with pushing back against what they saw as Microsoft defaults on what browser you use or something. And in fact, when I traveled to Europe, I then plugged in and immediately was offered an update from Microsoft called the European Commission made us offer you this update. Then you'll soon be presented with a menu that asks you if you really want to use IE or whatever. And then I just had to ignore the update until I got back to terra firma.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and the complaints against Microsoft in Europe certainly would not have flown against Microsoft in the United States. So that's the challenge of being Microsoft or any company that's offering services around the world. The very same behavior, legal in one space, can be illegal in another.
Hi, I'm Alex Fayette, undergrad from Yale University. We've seen the main police actor here, at least in the U.S., for trying to deal with this is the Department of Justice a lot of the time. And we've sort of seen both the United States government and a lot of governments around the world sometimes have difficulty dealing with, these issues on the internet and with tech policy. And there's a lot of confusion with these layers of regulation not fully grasping the tech community and the products. Do you guys think that that the Department of Justice, for instance, here in the U.S., is fully fit and capable to understand these sort of issues as they spiral out of control? Or should someone else be trying to police it?
Which is all to say, Larry, you've been very careful to say today that there may be public policy problems to think about, but it's for us to think about, not for DOJ to think about, because that would be premature. We're not calling for regulation. If it came down to something that you really thought was a problem in the world that the market wouldn't correct and that called for some kind of intervention, what level of faith do you have that the kind of intervention you'd get would map anything to what was really needed? Is it an expertise and a public choice problem?
Yeah, I mean, let's be clear. There's lots on the internet that I think we need public policy intervention to solve. The security issues are one. Spam issues are another. Privacy issues are a third. These are all issues that are public policy issues that require sensible, intelligent public policy intervention. Do I have faith that there's sensible, intelligent public policy intervention around the corner, on the horizon, whatever your metaphor is? No, I have no such faith. I mean, I've been astonished with how slowly the government has begun, any government really, but our government in particular, has even begin to recognize what it means to make public policy in the context of the internet. Points which are almost so conventional as to be trite to repeat in a context like, the Berkman Center, are completely anathema to policymakers. So
that could raise the costs of intervention in the real world and maybe then comparatively lower the costs of doing nothing. If we saw regulators around the world going on holiday and just announcing a cyber abstention doctrine, we're not sure we can get this right, we're just going to let you guys fight it out. Is there any way of saying 10 years from now, are we still going to be in a world with like three-dimensional Facebook and an even more medium-sized iPhone or whatever it may be? Or do you think there's like a whole new cast of proprietary characters maybe, but new characters that will displace the old ones without the help of efforts from regulators to break up concentration?
You know, the problem is, based on history of the internet, you would have to say, yeah, there's always going to be a new Google or a new Facebook or a new Twitter or a new person or entity that comes along and thinks about a radical new way to do something. But that intuition is fed by a very brief amount of history, right? And there are other people writing about development of technology. Tim Wu's got a great new book called Master Switch coming out about this, which tries to map the history of major technologies. And what we see is that at a certain point, in fact, the innovative opportunities for the technology close down. Like, major actors succeed in basically grasping control of the platform.
And this is your story of television and FCC in your book, Deborah Spars Ruling the Waves.
Exactly right. So we would be optimistic if we looked at the last 20 years and predicted the next 20 years are going to be like this. But that's exactly the mistake that financial service companies made with respect to mortgages, right? And house prices are always going to go up because all of our data shows they've
always gone up. So you think there might be an innovation bubble?
Yes.
And that we might be at the height of the innovation bubble?
Yeah.
We should sell innovation right now.
We certainly should.
And maybe another way to think about this in internet terms is there are some applications, and by application I mean that in the broadest sense, functionalities, affordances that we've come to appreciate as internet users that are owned, that there's some manager for that maybe created it, is responsible for it, can steer its evolution, and some that are unowned, that there's no one entity that can sign off on a change to it. Unowned would include electronic mail. Email is a set of standards that any subscriber, any server can subscribe to and then join the ranks of email servers, and now it's just part of the club. Email is a collective hallucination. Ditto for internet relay chat protocols and things like that. Ditto for the old news groups. But for each of these, we can see over the span of history an owned alternative offering some features that an unowned one can't easily come up with that includes security features that displaces it. And, you know, they say kids today, and if you're out there, kids today, let us know, don't use email. They just don't use it anymore. They're using Facebook messaging. They're doing direct messaging on Twitter. It's always weird when somebody like wants to ask like a really complicated question, like a colleague or something, and they DM me on Twitter. I'm like, no, really? Did you just DM me on Twitter? I'm just going to DM you, LOL. So that move from unowned to owned, is there any way you could see your prior observation when I asked you about Microsoft not allowing outside apps being even more owned than it was, not generative? Your answer was, well, but it wouldn't have gotten 95% market share. There's this value in openness and interoperability that ends up being its own market pressure. And for my part, when I think of Facebook, I made a proposal at a talk at Facebook in 2007, which is, all right, you guys are doing great. You've already got plenty of money. Like, what next? And what if you were to publish the spec for a Facebook server? And now instead of there being one Facebook.com to rule them all, carved up in various ways with quote-unquote communities, why not let anybody set up a Facebook server? Then those Facebook servers could negotiate with other Facebook servers as to how transparently to let identities flow between the two. And it basically includes adding the at sign. So I might be Jay-Z at the Harvard Facebook server, and then other Facebook servers would credit that that's a reputable institution and it's okay to allow friending to take place.
I'm sure they love that idea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
An earthquake actually happened shortly thereafter. We went out for dinner and the ground shook and they left quickly. So no, they did not, to my knowledge, adopt the idea yet. But if they were, first, could you see reasons over the long term why that would be a great idea to adopt for Facebook, that actually by being that open, by loosening their grip, they would actually grasp more because then more people would be using Facebook and they'd find other ways to monetize and proprietize? Or do you think, no, what we see in the future is tightening up once you've achieved a certain size?
Yeah, well, let's just make sure that the point I think you were hinting at is clear. We went from a place, let's say 1994, where the dominant platform was owned, yet there was freedom to build on top of that platform.
And by owned, you're talking about the dominant client PC platform.
Yeah, it was
owned because nobody used GNU Linux at that time. It didn't exist.
Yeah.
And people were using Windows.
That's right.
But they could run outside apps.
Yeah, and they could run whatever apps they want on top of it. And then there was a big fight over that owned platform.
Right.
At the time that this unowned platform was beginning to be...
Here you're talking about the internet.
Exactly right. The protocols of the internet, not owned. Protocols of HTML, not owned.
And you might normally think of those as apples and oranges, because one's a computer and one's a network. But as we've seen, the network actually can be the computer.
Right. So the network displaced the computer as the place that people were interested in writing applications for. Okay, so this unowned platform, circa 2000, 2001, becomes extremely exciting. Well, that's just after the bust.
Exciting to users, less exciting to financiers.
Yeah. Yes. Right, especially after the bubble burst. Okay, but what we've seen since then is the evolution or the re-evolution of these owned platforms, right? So every major success since then has been this interesting trick of getting millions, half a billion users to opt into something for one reason or another, but then the thing they're opting into is something which the owner exerts control or has the right to exert ultimate control over. And so we've seen efforts that are counter to that. So Second Life, for example, did something like your idea with Facebook, right? So Second Life...
They open sourced their client.
And they also promised to open source their server.
They promised.
Yeah, and they're not sure whether they backed off of that or it just takes longer to do it than they want. But that was pointing the direction you're talking about. But nobody else does. Everybody else is about... Join, play with me, do whatever you want to do, and I'm going to give you the ability to do whatever you want to do, and that's why you're going to join my service, but ultimately the service is mine. And these other platforms are massively more significant than even Windows was in 1994. Were there 500 million people in 1994 that had something to do with the Windows operating system? No, right? So the point is this is much more significant as a kind of owned universe than anything that we are fighting.
And the fact that there were these owned platforms that even competed with the internet, the CompuServes, the AOLs, and the internet cleaned their clock out of left field is not necessarily cause for hope?
No. At least right... So right now, the reason these owned platforms are succeeding is that they're able to leverage data so effectively.
That gets back to your data point.
Yeah. So the data layer becomes the critical driving point of competition. Now, again, it might be that we, you know, come up with something radically new that is the thing that's driving value. But the data is driving the value right now. And the earlier stage when we weren't actually collecting data in any interesting way doesn't really counter that.
Which I guess then makes it just a more complicated question if one were to say, so does that mean we are somehow less free in 2010 than we were in 1994? It's awfully hard to say. From an affordances point of view, there's less we can do now. There's clearly much more we can do. But I guess as there is more we can do, those who can shape it, affect it, ultimately surveil it and control it may also have increased in ranks from 1994.
Absolutely have.
You're listening to a very special season premiere of Radio Berkman. This week, we listen in on Jonathan Zittrain and Larry Lessig as they talk about the nature of competition in the technology sphere. They took several questions from an invited audience of summer interns from the Berkman Center, or Berkterns. Berkturn and co-producer Molly Soder asked Jonathan and Larry for their thoughts on how we recognize and regulate search engines, which are not only becoming more robust, but more and more like utilities.
I was wondering if either of you had any comments on the current search neutrality fight going on and possibly on the proposed search commission, the Federal Search Commission that came up in a paper a few years ago.
So Larry, that's a great question for you.
Is it? I thought it was your question.
What's your reaction to the prospect of a Federal Search Commission or some other way that basically says, this was Frank Pasquale's idea, but that says... Search isn't just another application. It's no solitaire. It's the first piece of clod of dirt we hit with a spade when we start exploring the net. And what happens when we put in a term and it gets matched up with stuff we should then go to, where we only read the first page, that's a crucial operation and hard for markets to judge because It's not like if I don't find what I'm looking for, I'm like, ah, I'll bet Dogpile can help me. I just assume it's not there. So the market may not be that fluid. Is there a problem with search right now, and is there some way to fix it that involves a public intervention of some kind?
So I'd be very skeptical of a public intervention, and partly because, you know, the great innovation in the history of search was a company that wanted to demonstrate that it was being neutral about search, or at least make it possible to demonstrate to say, here's the neutral search results, right? So you remember in the birth of Google, at that time, there was all sorts of search engines out there that were in the business of selling search results or saying, here, we're going to monetize this by making it so that you can really buy your way to the very top. And what Google seemed to offer was this clean search engine with integrity. Now, it's not that they weren't going to sell ads, but they were clearly marked off. So you could distinguish in your head between what the market was telling you and what the, you know, what the money market was telling you and what the influence market was telling you. But still, that's what made them so compelling to at least a large number of people who felt that was an important value to have here. Now, that's not to say that there aren't things that search engines could do that, you know, even antitrust authorities should worry about. So let's imagine Google decided there's a competing video search engine out there, and we want to kill it.
So it'll just be dead to the index.
Yeah.
No
so
links to that engine.
And that engine, we won't allow it to sell. We won't sell Google Ads to it. We won't allow it to do anything in our space so that people could learn about it. Now, that might be an example of the kind of monopolization or defensive monopolization that I was complaining about or talking about in the very beginning. And so I guess if I were a policymaker in this context, would try to identify the kinds of things that I'm worried about and not imagine something like a, you know, federal search commission that would be as ineffective as the Federal Communications Commission has been in supporting competition and innovation.
So defensive monopolization is kind of the easy case. It's the one most supported by doctrine and kind of least controversial. How about somebody wants to buy AdWords next to a search for Barack Obama that links to their tract? They've got the check. They're ready to write for it. They're going to pay Google's market rate. And Google says, nah, we just prefer not to show your ad. Take your business elsewhere. Good, bad?
So I'd prefer it's not like that. But I don't yet. I don't think we have a clear way to say that there's a legal wrong, right? I mean, we see this all the time with Super Bowl ads, and people get outraged every year when the Super Bowl refuses to sell ads to some lefty like progressive thing, but has all sorts of right wing message ads that get sold to
it. And you think that's bad?
So I think that's bad from the standpoint of I think it would be better if there were open competition here. But from a legal standpoint, it's hard, given the doctrine we've got right now, to see how we're going to attack that.
It is funny, though, because if Google made a choice, if you should type save the whales, you would probably object to Google quietly tweaking its search algorithms by hand to make sure that some save the whales organization that would not otherwise be featured comes up as the first actual hit. I assume you would not be happy with that. Is that right?
Well, maybe I wouldn't be happy with it, but what I was saying is that their objective to create integrity in their search results, or at least integrity as perceived by the public, was a market advantage for them.
Yes.
And so if the question was, do we need a regulator to come in and police this, I was saying, well, in fact, we see some good examples of how we achieved what we were trying to achieve, neutral search results, without a regulator.
Right. But back on the sponsored links side, would you object if Google chose to give away the top sponsored link to some little Save the Whales organization that couldn't afford to write the check, thereby displacing, denying that spot to somebody that has the big check and is like, wait a minute, I'm being unfairly treated?
I wouldn't, because I want to save the whales.
Okay, so your ideals are completely contingent just on, you're an outcome-based jurist is what you're saying.
I'm kind of an iPhone jurist, that's right. Contingently principled.
Contingently principled jurist. All right, well, this... episode then ends with the failure of Larry Lessig's ever being confirmed at the Supreme Court, given the statement he just made. So we're pleased to have offered that up and look forward to those words being repeated at a judicial confirmation hearing someday to the robot that holds the brain of Orrin Hatch after he's achieved life extension protocols. And let us say that this is the pilot, the very first episode of something we're experimenting with. We make no assumptions about who will listen or how many. It's kind of like the pilot episode of Star Trek, obviously cast the wrong person as the Doctor. There was no DeForest Kelly in the first instance, but then they eventually got it right. So we're hoping through an iterative process to make this something that, as Larry was just saying moments ago, is something the public would want and that we can later sell sponsored ads next to. So... for our next episode, now that we've sort of put a stake in the ground, we're eager to hear from whoever has gotten this far in the podcast and listening to it. If you've got a comment or a question or something that we could put into the mailbag, eventually we could make this basically like Car Talk, and then I could say, "Don't compute like my brother!" or something else like that as the show starts to gain character. Larry, any final thoughts on the show as we wrap it up?
We're really going to wait to see what people say the next topic should be before we pick what it is.
Well, we think the next topic will be net neutrality in light of, here it being late summer 2010, the astonishing news in the papers that Google and Verizon have achieved some form of concordat that I guess news is still sketchy, but might mean that Google no longer thinks network neutrality is the reality they're aiming for.
That would be a great topic. Why don't we talk about that next?
It's a deal. But we'll also have a viewer mailbag fortune where you can ask whatever you want. And if our screeners allow it through, it will be answered. That's how we achieve question neutrality on our program. So with that said, we owe a huge thanks to the Berkterns and others who turned out to ask questions and provide some studio audience for today's program. And we'd like to thank the Berkman Center sponsors, all of whom are listed on the Berkman Center disclosure page at cyber.law.harvard.edu/disclosure.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, Larry.
The show is a production of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Please go ahead and share any comments, compliments, or criticisms with us on our show page, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. We're also working on a name for what we hope will be a regular feature with Jonathan and Larry. If any ideas come to mind, go ahead and shoot us a comment on the blog post for this episode. Today's episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, and Molly Soder, with additional assistance from Lisa Carlovati, Seth Young, Kathy McGillicuddy, Jake Shapiro, and Colin McClay. And extra special thanks to today's two guests, Larry Lessig and Jonathan Zittrain. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.